We're continuing on in our theme for this year called To Know and To Be Known. That's our hope and our prayer this entire year, for the entirety of 2017, started just at the beginning of January. You've heard it said probably every week since the beginning of the year. But this is what we're shooting for. This is what we're hoping for. That we believe that if we focus on this as a church, as a community, that not only will this church look differently, but this city will look differently. Because when we know one another and when we are in relationship with one another, it's easier to communicate and relate and to have grace for one another. So the first 5 weeks of the series, we focused on this incredibly rich work by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, an author, a theologian, a pastor, called Life Together. And we talked about the importance of community. And now, because it's the month of February and because we just had Valentine's Day on Tuesday, we're going to focus 3 weeks on relationships. What's your relationship status? How would you define the relationships in your life? Are they good? Are they not so good? Are they okay? Are they so-so? Are they absolutely not going very well at all? And if they aren't, how do we go about improving the status of our relationships? Or maybe more importantly, does God have anything to say about these relationships? So last week we talked about family, and we talked about family is this relationship that's incredibly important, but it's forced. And I don't say that because I don't love my family. I love the family I grew up in, but the reality is the five of us are each human, and we all have baggage because we're all products of our humanity. And so when we think about our relationship status with our families, we need to be really honest. And there's a lot of forgiveness that has to be played out in our relationships. And I was overwhelmed this past week at just all of the stories that were shared about different hardships, but also joys that take place in family. Well, this week we're going to take a step farther. We're going to talk about what does the relationship that we have with our friends look like? And this is something that can be hard, and this is something that can be difficult because some of us are here and we're new to town and we're new to this area. So maybe you came to worship alone by yourself. You feel like you're alone, you feel like you're by yourself, but stick with us for the year and we'll learn more about each other and we'll be community. But you say, you know what, I don't have this. Friendships are something that comes difficult for me. So I'm more of an introvert, or I don't like people as much. So friendships isn't something that's just always been just a part of my life. Or maybe you're a part of a whole bunch of different friendships, but none of them seem to be able to go past that surface level. And you want to know, what would God want for my relationships with my friends? That clip that you saw at the beginning of the sermon comes from the television show Friends. That television show was one that absolutely shaped a generation of people. And I don't say that flippantly. You can say, Jeremy, it was just a TV show. No big deal. No. The TV show ran from September of 1994. I was a junior in high school. And it ran for 10 seasons. The last episode aired in May of 2004. There was over 230 episodes played during this series. Friends aired on Thursday. Actually, you can still watch episodes of Friends probably every single day of the week at every hour of the day. But it would happen on Thursday nights. And this was interesting. The thing that's so fascinating of the impact on this show that it had on not just my culture, but people who are younger than me and also people who are older than me, is it happened at a time before social media, before the ability that we had. If you actually wanted to talk to somebody, you actually had to dial their number on your telephone and speak to their voice, or you had to meet them someplace. There wasn't the reality of a virtual world at this point. It was something that was completely foreign to us. And so these friends, they spent most of their time in this coffee shop called Central Perk. And when we watched the show, we could literally envision ourselves meeting with a group of people that were like that in our own place. a place that was carved out, a place where we did life together. And we all need those places. Sociologists would refer to that as a third space, the space between your work and your home, where you meet with people. If we were talking a century ago, that would be the church, that everybody would be. It was the center of civic, of day-to-day life. The other thing that was so fascinating about this show, it's because it took place at a time where people were getting married later, if at all. People were having children later, if at all. And so there were these years where you weren't in your parents' house anymore. You'd opted to leave your parents' house, or maybe for some of us, our parents kicked us out of their house. Said, you can't stay here any longer. You got to go do life on your own. But you hadn't really grown up yet. So you're trying to make sense of the world, and in order to make sense of the world, you needed people to do life with. And the relationship between these people, it wasn't easy, and it didn't always come naturally, and it was messy. But it was something that was incredibly important. But it's not just for the people on that show. It's for us as well. Friendship can be an art, especially in the world that we live in now, that can be lost. There's a researcher by the name of Robin Dunbar, was from Oxford University, did a study, and the reason that this person did the study was trying to figure out and trying to determine the size of an animal's brain based on the amount of people or the amount of animals that it flew with or it ran with or it swam with. And this researcher said that the larger the brain, the bigger the group was in that herd, which goes to show why I have such a small group of friends. You know, I mean, one to the other. But in the process of this, this researcher saw that it wasn't just with animals or birds or fish. It was also, and even more strongly correlated, to humans as well. And this researcher uncovers this central truth that you and I know to be true. Because we see it in the beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 2. Very beginning, God creates Adam and Eve, He puts Adam in the garden, and then all of creation is there, but God sees that there is something that's missing, that there's something that's incomplete. And God says, Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, he says, the Lord God said, it is not good for man to be alone. It's not good for humans to be alone. That we were created and we were designed, and it's absolutely necessary that we would have people that we can rely on, we can do life with. This is in the 1930s. I've shared this before, but I find it fascinating. If I were to ask you what the most basic fundamental needs a human being has, we would say that the most fundamental and basic need that we have is food, water, and shelter, right? Who could argue that? In the 1930s, there was a time where the American public was so poor, especially in the rural areas, that people were having children that they couldn't care for. So they're having children. They realized that they couldn't provide for their most basic needs, food, water, shelter. So they're handing these children over to wards of the state, to orphanages, to somebody who could provide for those basic, fundamental, those carnal needs. But much to their horror, the people who were taking care of even infants were noticing something awful that was taking place. That there were these infants that were literally dying of starvation, even with a bottle that was placed to their lips. And they realized what God had stated. It's the truth that is central to all of our lives. That the most basic, the most primal, the most fundamental need that we have as human beings, it is not food or water or shelter. The most basic, fundamental, and primal need that we have as human beings is love. That without it, we waste away. Which is the importance of friendships. This researcher started to study the different groups that we associate with and kind of found something that was pretty consistent across all people, regardless of where in the world that they lived and where they were from. And started to put it to numbers, that the first basic number that people have, the amount of people in a group that we will call that we're doing relationship with is 150. There's another sociologist who wrote a book over 10 years ago, probably closer to 20 years ago. Guy's name is Joseph Myers. He wrote a book called The Search to Belong, which is kind of a marginal book, but it has some incredible stuff in it. And he defines these numbers and he puts words to them. He defines them as spaces. He'd call the 150 and he'd call that our public space. And this researcher, this Robin Dunbar, what is stated is that it's this group of people, they're the ones that we may not know the names, we may not know the details, but we recognize them by face. They're very casual friends. Look around the worship center this evening. I know we're Lutheran, but still, look around. Even I look around. And I'm here every single week. Same service, same time. And I would say I know almost all of you by face. But unfortunately, there are many of you, not because I don't care, or there's many of you that recognize one another and you don't know anything else, not because you don't care, but that's as kind of deep as that relationship goes. It's impossible to have close personal friendships with this many people. Sometimes I think we do ourselves a disservice if we try to force a close relationship in the wrong space. It's baseball season. Pitchers and catchers reported last week. First full workouts were today. I'm ecstatic because the Twins are still in first place right now. And it will last a day. But imagine if I were to go to a Twins game, and at the Twins game, I were to be seated next to somebody. Never met that person before. Beginning of the game, I realized I was going to spend 3 hours next to this person, said, "Hi, my name's Jeremy," and they introduced themselves back. Didn't have much interaction for the rest of the game, and imagine if the Twins, now you have to imagine really, you have to put yourself in a fantasy land, because imagine that the Twins score the winning run. And everybody gets up and they cheer and they're ecstatic. And so myself and the person who's seated next to, we high five and we hug. And we're like, yes, this is the best thing ever. And we're cheering and we're cheering and we're cheering. Well, how awkward if I were to look at that person and say, "Hey, you want to grab coffee tomorrow?" The person would be like, I thought it was just the five and the hug and the score and then that whole thing. Not all of our relationships are going to get beyond this. And that's okay. But imagine if this person and I both had season tickets. And we went to every single home game. It'd be 81 of them. By the end of that season, we probably would go into the next group that Dunbar talks about, or Myers talks about, identified by the number 50. That's your social space. Those are the people that I would say, I would refer to, that these are the people that get your Christmas card. You know their name. You know a little bit about their family. You may know some of their interests and hobbies and passions. You may even know what they do for a living. But beyond that, you don't know too much more. The interesting thing about the people that exist in these two spaces is people are very migratory and transient in these spaces. The 150 people that were in my public space 10 years ago when I lived in Fargo, North Dakota, they aren't the same people in that space for me now. People come and people go in these two spaces, but there's more. Dunbar says the next group down is a group of about 15, 10 to 15. Joseph Myers would call that this is the private space. These are the people who you just don't know their name and what they do, but you know about their families. You know their joys and their struggles. They're the people that if they have a loved one in their family that passes away, you show up at the funeral to support them. They're the people that we could say they're a part of your tribe. They're the ones that really know you. And then the smallest group that Dunbar would talk about and that Myers would write about is your group of five can be as small as three. That's your intimate space. We get the word intimacy screwed up in our culture. We think that this word intimate, we think it means something that's romantic or something that's physical that takes place in a romantic relationship. But that's not what the word intimacy only means. Yes, in my marriage with my wife, Bridget, we have an intimacy that we don't share with anybody else. The word intimacy literally comes from two words. The word inna comes from this word that means inside, inna, inside. The mata means the sheath that would encase your blood vessels. It's the people that you let into the most delicate places of your life. It's the unfortunate thing that exists in our lives is we do fairly well in these first two, maybe three categories. But it's right here that we have a lot of work to do. Because this is hard. This is scary. It's in this space where sometimes we share things that make us feel very much at risk of being hurt. So say, yeah, Jeremy, I get it. I know it. So how do we do it? Well, I'm glad you asked. Because I want to share with you Jeremy's keys to relationships, which you should probably take everything I say and do the exact opposite. But the first one that we need to do is to define the relationship, to define it. To name it. To be able to know. My wife and I do this every year. As we close out a year, right before New Year's, we sit down together as a couple and we start to talk about what are the 3 to 5 relationships that we have in our own personal lives and the relationships that we have as a couple? What relationships are we going to be able to pour into? That we're going to allow ourselves and take the risk to be vulnerable, to define it so that we can develop it. So often we find ourselves dancing between so many different spaces and we never make the opportunity to be friends. Life's busy. It's always going to be busy. And especially given a screen-based world that we live in now, makes it even more difficult. The second part of this is not just to define it, but to invest in it. there's this whole thing that Dunbar talks about in the research and says that it's kind of a misnomer that we could somehow have incredibly intimate friendships on social media. Nowhere in the research is it said that relationships or having friends on Facebook or following people on Twitter or following people on Instagram or whatever other social media medium you use, it never says that any of that is bad or it's wrong. But there's a whole big difference between following and friendship. So there's a big difference between doing life with one another and observing life of the other. And unfortunately, when we do so much of this, we have no ability to do any of this or any of this. Dunbar finds out that there is no correlation between the amount of friends or interactions that you have in social media and your actual friendships. That one doesn't necessitate the other. But unfortunately, we've started to try to replace it. Walk into a Starbucks or walk into a Caribou or walk into any coffee shop or restaurant or bakery that you frequent. Walk in there. That's your homework for this week. It's fascinating. When you start to think about it and you start to look through this lens, you'll see how little face-to-face interaction we have with one another anymore. You can walk into a coffee shop and you'll see a shop that's full, packed. You can't find a table to sit. But so many of the tables, even if they seat four, are occupied by one. Or they're occupied by four, but everybody at that table is all plugged into something other than one another. In order to develop our friendships and in order to be able to deepen this, we have to start to invest. This is a good friend of mine. We get together about once a month. We get together for breakfast and we kind of share. He's more of a mentor than anything else. He's really smart and I'm really not, and so it's a great relationship. And so it wasn't this past Thursday, but it was the Thursday before, and we had met at Panera that morning, and he and I were talking, and we were just talking about, he knew what series was coming up at Hope, and so he was asking me, he's like, hey, what are you going to be preaching on? So I was kind of telling him kind of high-level, like what I was thinking about, and I started to talk about friends, and we started to talk about conflict, and started to talk about the difficulty that comes when we don't always see eye to eye. He said, Jeremy, here's one of the things that I see in my job, in my work, in my family. We do a lot of talking, but we do so little living. So many times we'll have a relationship that will not be going very well any longer, or there's something that's just happened where it just doesn't come as naturally as it once did. And so we might even take that person and we might sit across the table from them and we might start to say, okay, what's going on? Why aren't we the way that we used to be? And we'll talk about it and we'll acknowledge it, but we won't do anything about it because this doesn't come naturally to us. It'd be like with me and my wife, with my wife and I, we found out over the last 3 weeks, both of our kids have gotten pink eye. It'd be like going to the doctor and saying, hey, we think our kid has pink eye. And the doctor would say, yep. And we'd say, all right, good talk. We'll see you later. You'd say, Jeremy, you'd never do that. You'd say, okay, what do I give them? What medicine am I going to take to make it better? How am I going to invest in the health of my child? What are you doing to invest in the health of your relationships? We want to say it's different, but it's not. We do a lot of diagnosing, but we tend not to do very much work. When you invest in something, it shows that you're actually committed to it, that it matters to you. And when somebody matters to you, or when you know that you matter to someone, It affects the way that you do relationships, right? You can't not affect that. When I know that somebody loves me and is invested in the relationship, that it doesn't matter what happens, and it doesn't matter the bad days that I may have, and it doesn't matter the fact that I have all these eccentric things that I do, when I know when that person invests in me, I commit to it. But we don't commit easily. We see it all over. We see it in our friendships. We see it in our marriages. We have absolutely a fear of commitment. Because we think that if we commit, it means agreement. It means we think that if we commit to something, and if that person somehow does something in a way that I don't like, or rubs me the wrong way, well, then I have no time for it. We have a way of convincing ourselves that the world revolves around us. And the byproduct are relationships that are all about power. Who's in, who's out, who gets to decide. And when power becomes the thing that is at play in your friendships, you'll lose them. I mean, how many of you have gone through junior high? I mean, no matter how positive an experience you had in junior high, it was miserable, wasn't it? It's the most difficult time of your life. Why? Because this was never settled. Kids don't have the mental capacity to be able to commit the way that you and I should. So that's what Jesus is talking about in John chapter 15. The Bible reading that Jody read for us just a short time ago. You see, the foundation of all of these things is love. Think about love. Love, in its truest sense, is not about me. Love, from a biblical perspective, the way that we have experienced it through a God who loved us so much that he would not stand at a distance, a God who loved us so much that he defined what the relationship was all about, a God that loved us so much that he invested in us, a God that loved us so much that he committed to us, and that there was nothing that you and I could ever do that would break the commitment that he had made to us, that he had promised to us. I mean, you think about Jesus' life, and you think about the rhythms of his life. He operated in all of these spaces. He preached to the crowds. He sent the 72. He called the 12. And he did life with the 3. Peter, James, and John. The ones who were at the center. The ones that when Jesus would go off at the Mount of Transfiguration and Jesus is going and God shows up and the light shines on Jesus and he's illuminated. It's Peter, James, and John that are there. Think about the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus was at the most burdensome time of his life. It couldn't have been more difficult than it was for Jesus in that moment. And Jesus knows that he can't go there alone. I mean, how many times have you gone through something in your life that the cost was so high that you knew that you needed somebody that would be with you there? Going through chemo, you have the person who comes and sits by your bedside because you know you need those people who don't just know your joys and your struggles, but share your joys and your struggles. It's what Paul's talking about in Romans chapter 12. Don't just pretend to love one another. Really love one another. Love each other with genuine affection, the kind of love that comes from God. Listen to this. I mean, think about the words that Jesus had just had a meal with his disciples, John chapter 14. And Jesus had told them that he wasn't going to be able to be with them very much longer. So Jesus is giving them this farewell speech to his friends. He says, I have told you these things so that you would be filled with my joy. Yes, that your joy will overflow. This is my commandment. Love each other. Love each other in the same way that I have loved you. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. There's no greater. Jesus says, I've told you these things so that you'd have my joy and your joy would overflow. And you find that and you experience that when you start to live your life and you start to love those around you in a way that isn't self-serving, but it's sacrificial, but not sacrificial in a way that it pains us, sacrificial in a way that we see it fill the person who's next to us. I mean, that's one of the things that we've experienced as a family that's so profound about family camp. Do you walk, if you're looking for deep, lifelong friendships, if your family's looking for friendships, talk to the people at the camp's booth right outside of the worship center. You get to do life with one another, share life with one another. There are people in this room that have gone every single year for decades because of the Christ-centered friendships that are established there. We need more of this. We don't need more of this. This is what we need. This is what Jesus points us to. It's not easy, it's messy. There's a chance that you can get hurt in it, but it's with it. I've told you this, Jesus says, so that your joy would overflow. It would be made complete in the love that I have for you that you give to the world around you.